So this is a primer, which is
a primer.
Did I spell it wrong? It's like a foodist or a flautist or a tomato or a tomato. Okay, so and it's kind of a low tech primer, and part of it was just what? Yeah. Just to get everybody in the right mood. Okay, so what I wanted to do was to sort of just go through data, sort of as much as possible, not from my laboratory, some from my laboratory, to just get people thinking about sort of the functional aspects of cortical anatomy. And there are sort of two goals. I mean, one is if you open up, is Boris here? I can tell the story. If you open up a standard neuroscience textbook, it's sort of a march, right? With the exception of Kufler's book, right, which you start at the retina and you march, you know, lens, photoreceptor, bipolar cell, retinal gate, you march all the way to finally a hairbrush cell in IT. But part of this is just a reminder, in fact, that really the way the central nervous system is designed is really a session of inculcated feedback loops at every level. So even at the primary level, the information that comes in is already being gated and it's already being modified by feedback from high level. You're already throwing things away, pulling out features. So I just wanted to sort of emphasize that point. Okay, so since Boris is not here, so many, many years ago, Boris and I wrote what he considered to be his last paper in neuroscience, first and last, and with Clay, who's quietly sitting in the back of the room. But Boris decided to learn some neuroscience. He walks in one day, and he has this big welt on his nose, and I said, "What, you know, what happened, right? Do you have a fight with your, you know, now wife and girlfriend?" And he goes, no, I was in bed, and I was reading Kandel and Schwartz, which, if those of you who don't know, weighs about 55 pounds and is part of the exercise routine at all these New York places. And he was reading the book in bed, and then he started to doze off, and wham! Okay, so this is a famous diagram. I think it's famous because no one actually tried to follow the wires in it. It's just totally interconnected. This comes from sort of David Van Essen. It was basically looking at sort of outputs layer 5 and looking to what visual area these outputs went to and from one area to the next, and sort of making this connectivity diagram. And the impression one gets from these diagrams is that information just flows forward. But it was pointed out early on, the reference actually should be 1988, in sort of a rebuttal to this diagram by Rodney Douglas and Kevin Martin, that in fact, from their own recordings and from that of others, that if you look at any spot in the visual system within sort of 40 milliseconds from when a scene turns on, relatively quickly compared to the time scale once you move your eyes from one place to the other, okay, all parts of the visual system are seeing the same thing. And in fact, this is sort of not the way you'd like to look at it, but you'd like to look at sort of sensory systems and along to sensory motor systems as every place sort of has the same information, okay, and you're making decisions. So that was pointed out early on. And so it's just before we sort of move on to sort of general aspects of cortical feedback, let me just talk about a little already what happens in V1. So there's already, when you go from retina up through, already in the retina, of course, there's feedback. I mean, the levels of light can control the levels of dopamine. And at high light levels, in fact, you tend to process signals in a way that the center is sort of minus the surround. And at very dark levels, you tend to pull the input from many photoreceptors together, form a larger receptive field. You sort of lose this decorrelation. So there's already feedback, of course, at the retina. But Adam Sileto started looking at the effect of feedback from cortical levels already onto the LGN. He looked at feedback from sort of the output, one of the output layers of cortex, layer 6, feeding back to the LGN. And His data is a little controversial, but it's just worth pointing out already how features already get changed or extracted at subcortical levels. So one experiment was to take bars of different length, this length versus that length, and look at the response, okay, in LGN to bars of different length. And this was an example where the cell responded very nicely to a short bar, but a long bar, in fact, suppressed the response, okay? And then because layer 6 and LGN are separated by such a large distance, it's possible to go into layer 6 with a sodium channel blocker, lidocaine, and actually change the nature of the response. And in fact, here, in the absence of feedback, you have essentially the same response to bar 1. So this is very, very fundamental to the extent you look at pictures being pulled together by edges at different lengths, the whole response has changed. Another feature, very much in the same guise, had to do with pop-out phenomena, okay? With cortical feedback, you're very sensitive to if you had a feature that you had a moving grating, okay, and you had a defect in that moving grating, you could pick it out very quickly with feedback present. And with feedback present, you sort of suppress the response to regions that didn't have a break. This is a break in orientation. These are moving gratings with the same spatial and temporal frequency. And now if you have the same break, you lose this ability in the absence of cortical feedback. So this, maybe Clay, you could add to this. This seems to be the sort of two classic examples that come back with feedback. Boris is here. I noticed you didn't bring your Kandel and Schwartz. What? Okay, so the other thing that comes from vision, all of a sudden, it gets very abstract as to what the roles of feedback are. So now we sort of move from experimental reality to sort of conjecture. Then area MT gets input not just from the LGM, but from this other visual pathway, the pulvinar pathway. Okay, and if I understand correctly, something on the order of half the cells in the retina are actually projecting through this other pathway, this pulvinar pathway. I noticed that was actually left out of Kandel and Schwartz, the entire book. It's kind of interesting. And these are cells that respond to motion. These are cells, if you have moving dots going across a field, will start to fire very, very quickly. And again, this also comes from a review article by Adam Sillitoe. And I don't think that the issue of the wiring diagrams he puts on are very important. But the conjecture here is that you get, there's a strong feedback connection from area MT all the way back down to primary visual area V1. V1 is the area where you're most sensitive to having edges or bars, okay, move across the field. So what could knowledge of motion actually gain you? That was the question he asked. So this is already a conjecture, right? Maybe a conjecture one now could answer with the right tools by incapacitating or turning off with output neurons from MT. But the thought, a little bit like happens in the retina, what Michael Berry and Marcus Meister worked on, is this idea that you're computing motion in one area, you're computing edges in the other area, and the notion is that, in fact, you can start to precondition these cells, start to depolarize cells that are in the direction of a moving bar and make them sort of hypersensitive to this moving bar. So it's pure conjecture. Okay, so it's sort of the most studied, if you talk to ask what's the most studied sensory area for sensory physiology, right? It's the visual area. It pains me to say it, but it's true. And there's just sparingly few examples, okay, of the role of feedback, despite the fact that every textbook starts with the words, and of course there's massive feedback connections. Okay. Yeah.
You mentioned it's 40 milliseconds. What
do you mean?
You said that you have responses in all areas after 40 minutes.
I think the...
I can't imagine how you can compute something with feedback.
What I meant to say is that I didn't mean that there were the delays of 40 milliseconds across this area. I meant that sort of, at least the statement from Douglas and Martin is that within 40 milliseconds from the turning on of a visual scene, you've reached an equilibrium, quote, an equilibrium in the system where all areas are active.
I mean, maybe not stimulus-driven?
What do you mean? Is that too short? Or, I mean, in fact, the connections had feedback would have to be on the order of a few of a few. I only know from, not, I don't know from vision, I know from the vibrissae area. It takes, you know, 3 milliseconds, you're from one cell to the next. Is that, Koi, do you have some?
Especially if you have internet. You know, once you get into that work, it's like, is there that latency on
this was a useful talk. Somebody, you made it a useful talk. I was worried that this was long. You seem. It's an experiment. It's the issue. It's an experimental reality. It's not. It's not a.
So the responses you were using were right, right? So there's some.
It hasn't been explained yet, but the
I could have made 5 slides. I want you to know I stayed up late last night putting this together, but I could have put 5 slides together at this. Yeah. Yes. Right. Right. Okay. So I think this is a great point. So I've read that. Okay. So I read that paper. He had a paper in Penis about 6 months ago, right? If I remember correctly. Okay. So I read. So that was. Okay. So that's actually a strong statement. So if I understood it right, he basically took to the best that group to the best of their knowledge took all the measured responses in different areas of the visual system, like what kind of features are being sensed, right? So this, with all the biases of an approach that says you listen to the loud neuron, okay? I mean, this is an important point because someone brought up population code, and you could have many weak reporters, and you could add many weak reporters together, of course, to get a very strong response. But most experiments are done by looking at small numbers of strong reporters. So that's a critical bias that went here. And the other bias, as you point out, is taking this very feed-forward view. Okay, and within that kind of data, if I remember right, he took, well, I hate to say natural scenes. I mean, a lot of these things were traffic in Cambridge, so maybe that's what natural scenes means today. Okay, and he would decode for salient features within these scenes. It was a rather reasonable visual task, right? So he picked a particular task. Okay, within that task, he got like a 70% hit rate, if the numbers were right, just using this naive feed-forward model. So I thought that was quite a success, right? It was sort of a self-consistency argument. People have been recording for 30 years. You finally take all the data, put it together, use some, in some crude sense, some ideal observer, right, to ask if you could pull out salient features and find out you can get about 2/3 of them. So that's does that summarize the work? Okay, so I'm not sure to go beyond it. You know, if naive model gives you 2/3 of success, I think that's great. Okay, so that's, I'll just take it as a sign of success. Okay, so, okay, so I wanted to actually to shift a little bit away from vision to something maybe that I'm a little more familiar with, and something where I think the stories on feedback are somewhat more complete. And this has to do with somatosensation, and it has to do with somatosensation where, as opposed to vision, where mostly monkeys and cats are mostly are used as the model system. This is done in the rodent, in the rat. Although with the advent of transgenics, miraculously mice can see. Okay, and so again, there's sort of this very traditional view. This comes from my colleague Martin Duchenne. In the retina world, you go from photoreceptors to bipolar cells to retinal ganglion cells. In the vibrissa world, you go from Merkel cells, these little balls that put out glutamate, to Merkel ending cells, to trigeminal ganglion cells. If you do the bookkeeping right, you get the same number of cells to go from the front end, and you march up through these areas, these spinal nuclei, okay, and then you march up to thalamus. There's multiple representations. In thalamus is actually four representations, but it's this very feed-forward look, and it finally takes you into vibrissa cortex. So this has sort of been a favorite of people in developmental biology because the boundaries, the cortical boundaries for a single column are very well defined, but that's just a statement that, unlike photoreceptors, which form like a sheath. I mean, here you have a sea of hairs, okay, and each hair has a very sharp representation in cortex. So this is this feed-forward picture, and it is true. If you take an animal and you anesthetize the animal, very natural condition, and you stimulate one hair and you wait 7 milliseconds, you get a very, very sharp response in this one region. Okay, but somehow that can't be enough because... So there's kind of a more modern view that's evolved. Most of this is due to my colleague Ahuda Hassar and somewhat to ourselves, in which you really have to look at the sensory motor system as a whole, okay? And it's just sort of our, just as a little bit of PR, it's our feeling that, in a sense, the vibrissa system is a very ideal place to look. And so instead of just marching all the way towards cortex, you have to think of feedback at every level. And I'll just sort of take you through this. I realize this is very cartoony, but I think it captures the essence of what's known. So this is a sensory organ. This is a vibrissa. But it's not just a sensory organ, it's a vibrissa which is buried in a follicle, and the follicle is moving back and forth. So just like the eye as a whole could move with the ocular muscles, in fact, the hairs can move. So the sensor is moving. So there's a motor aspect to sensation, which as time allows, I'll discuss. Okay, and then there's the output from the sort of the sensory part. And this goes as far as the brainstem. Now, by the time you get to the brainstem, you already have feedback that goes from brainstem nuclei, okay, over towards the motor control. And you might argue all the information is already here. So this, I think, is sort of interesting, and I think there's a theoretical challenge which is already posed, because you have one synapse of feedback at this point. This is a single synapse, okay? There are more complicated pathways in the brainstem that go back, but this is a single synapse. And this forms a closed loop, and in fact, you could even go in and isolate this part of the preparation and study it, right, as a single closed-loop preparation. Now, what happens is that these same nuclei, okay, project to the superior colliculus or tectum, if you will, and then so now this is one synapses, there's two internal synapses, and this feeds back again to these motor nuclei. So the single synapse path has in parallel with it a four synapse path, right? As you go up higher, okay, you know, into the cerebellar pontine complex, you again project over to colliculus, so now this pathway which has one synapse is replaced by a pathway which has five synapses. If we sort of march up through thalamus, and from thalamus to cortex, and then again back down to the superior colliculus or through multiple cortical centers, this single synapse is replaced in its shortest path by seven synapses. So this is sort of a way to look at the organization, is that you have a sensory signal that comes in, and there's finally a point where things branch to the motor end, and there's a single synapse at the brainstem end, and this is just replaced by sort of a series of nested loops with more and more complexity as you go up and up and up. And this seems to be the basic feature of all sensory motor systems. And I think there's a theoretical challenge here, because what you've done is, I'll change the timing in a second. See, it really puts the focus on the facial motor neurons. I mean, the normal thought is to look at motor neurons kind of as a, you know, big transistor, as a current source driving the muscles. But it's not quite true. These cells have very long dendrites, which means that the order in which inputs come in matters. Okay, so they could sort of arbitrate different inputs. So all these inputs are coming back together at the facial nucleus. So there's a theoretical point here just at how you could have these loops come together, and they work in a smooth way. I mean, the rat whisks. It whisks smoothly. Okay, so this is what one has to understand. So I was going to then pick various pieces of this and talk about the role of feedback. Yeah?
I just have one question. Does anybody know there are rodents with ferals that don't whisk? Morphologically they have barrels. The question is, which of these use that pass so they're in charge?
I think there was a conjecture on this by Frank Rice. So let me explain. The barrels are I think at a moment of drug experimentation, a number of people at Washington University looked at this picture, and it reminded them of barrels of beer. Okay.
It comes from a picture by Vandeleuze.
Vandeleuze, yeah.
It came from a Dutch picture
of beer.
Yeah.
Okay, but So there's two sensory signals that actually get into cortex, okay? One is the signal, which is called exafferents, okay, which is actually you're putting an external signal, like putting light onto the retina or compressing the follicle, compressing the pressure receptors in the follicle. So that's one signal. So that signal is there, whether or not the hair itself can move or not. Okay, so even within the rodent, there are hairs that move and there are hairs that don't move, okay? And then there's a second sensory signal that comes in, which is kind of the parallel of the proprioceptive signal, which just has to do with motion of the hair, where the hair is in space, which is, now you need both signals if you want to decode where you touched an object, okay? So when the hairs don't move, okay, it's unlikely then that you're going to get this proprioceptive signal. You certainly get it if they do move. No one's really, I don't know how you check if they don't move. Frank Rice actually made a sort of interesting observation that the follicles, the innervation of the follicles for the hairs that don't move actually is different. It's missing one of the sensory nerves coming out of it compared to the ones that do move. So I think the barrels make sense in terms of sensation coming from the outside world, but you've lost this sort of proprioceptive signal. So that could be the difference. Yeah. Okay. One more. Okay, so let me just warm you up. I don't know how many of you have picked up a rodent and had a good mano-a-mano with your favorite animal, but one of the reasons people like to study these is that you could actually teach them to whisk in an extremely symmetric manner, so both sides of the face are moving together, all the hairs are moving together. In a sense, then, you could take all the behavior, right? Even though there's many, many muscle groups that move the hairs together, you could take all this behavior and reduce it down to a scalar variable, which is just the motion of the hairs itself. I'll sort of show that to you. And then the other thing is that if you actually look at the motion, it's very, very regular. And you could, if you induce an animal to whisk, there's always these little papers that make a big difference. There was a discovery by psychologists in the 60s that if the animal actually smells a little bit of their own bedding, their home cage, they'll just start whisking. And the whisk was sort of, transform limited spectra, which means if they whisk for 10 seconds, then the width of their power spectrum is a tenth of a hertz. It's just, they're perfect clocks, right? So that's a great advantage in the laboratory, okay, because then you could really walk into this motion as opposed to other things going on in the brain. Now, of course, when the animals actually contact an object, all the symmetry is broken. This is from Prescott's laboratory, and you can watch the animals doing symmetric whisking and hits an object, it breaks away. So this is just a little bit of background on what's going on Okay, so there's two modes for their whisking. One is that they could thrust, like they're trying to try, in a laboratory, you could have the animal try to cross a gap. Okay, and what they'll do is they'll thrust their whiskers forward to make sort of the longest extension possible, and they'll sit there and they'll try to tap the head. And if they could tap something on the other side, they'll jump. Okay, you could argue about whether this is ethological or not. It seems to be, right? It's very natural for them. They learn this faster than any other behavior I know of in the laboratory. Okay, the other form of whisking is when they're really having these very, very large amplitude spreads back and forth. And this is, in fact, this is maybe the best way to study this interaction of these sort of more proprioceptive signals with touch signals, because you're having them move over the largest possible angle. So this sort of gives you the best experimental handle on the system. Excuse me?
How accurate do they know the position?
This comes from a guy named Per Knudsen, who was a Hood student, who's now working with me. And you can have them do a task where you get the rodent to keep its head fixed forward, okay? And you could ask them to differentiate the relative position of two pins, like they do in these tests for airplane pilots. And they could hit it within about 1.5 degrees. Okay, that's sort of the finest. That's pretty good. Okay, so let me make turn this into real numbers. If they're about two centimeters apart, they could hit it within about a millimeter. It's pretty accurate. And you got to remember the size of the animal, because what's going to happen? It's going to touch something. It's going to rotate. It seems they could get an accuracy, which is sort of beyond what they need behaviorally. Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to skip this. So let me just give you a little bit of background on the follicle. This is sort of the... So describing the molecular biology of pressure receptors is sort of the last open issue, in a sense, in sensory physiology. People have, most of this work is due to Richard Axel, where people have, cloned olfactory receptors. Now they're sort of cloning pain receptors. David Anderson, sort of a predominant character in this business. But the way the follicle is set up is you have a hair that runs down the follicle, and there are rings of receptors around the hair. And the point and this whole space then is a cavity, and it's engorged with blood. And in fact, if you look, these are labels of these so-called Merkel cells, these green dots over here. In fact, what happens when the hair moves, you actually start to distort this surface, and you're presumably measuring pressure on these different cell types. So the molecular biology of these has not been described, but one could actually look and see what the distortions of this ring are due to movements of the hairs. And maybe just to echo a little bit Mike's question, is that the follicles are spaced very close to each other. So this pressure, this distortion of this sheath that's sensitive to pressure by movement of the hair within the follicle. But then you have the follicles pressed next to each other, lined up in a row. So as the follicles move, okay, they're also pressing them on each other. Okay, so that's another distortion that you could pick up. And this is probably the basis of this proprioceptive signal. Okay. Okay, so let me just... So again, I mentioned that there's these two at the sensory end, right? You have signals that are already split. There are signals that carry this exafferent information about touch per se, and there's ones that carry information about position. But let's look a little bit at what happens already down here at the brainstem level. So there's an experiment that was done by Martin Duchenne, which I just like to describe. So if you're naive and you take a brain slice of the brainstem, which means you go to an animal and you ask it for a very thin section, okay, out of its brainstem, and you stain it with a dye that highlights sort of the RNA, okay, sort of the message, right? So each cell lights up, and you stare at this, and you don't see anything for a long amount of time, right? But then you go to one of your anatomy friends. In this case, it's Harvey Carton. And you begin to see that cells in different areas have slightly different sizes. You begin to see that the fiber tracks run in different directions to different areas. And you can start to see that this structure, in fact, is broken up into a number of regions. And the way this works is that there's a sensory nerve that comes in the trigeminal nerve, and it passes along this axis here, and it sends out to projections to different areas. This one is called principalis. This is sort of the area which is most responsive to single sensation, to one vibrissa. Then it goes into these other areas called aralis, and interpolaris, and caudalis. So there's a multiplicity of maps, okay, of the same vibrissa already at the brainstem, principalis, aralis, interpolaris, caudalis, coming in. This is a sagittal section. So the ganglion, the trigeminal ganglion, trigeminal nucleus is here. I don't want to turn myself into an atlas, okay? And I'm cutting like this, okay? So I'm cutting sagittally, okay? So basically this thing is a zucchini, and it pulls a little bit to the side, okay? So I don't get the whole zucchini because I'd have to tilt at around 15 degrees to get the maximum projection. So Martin Duchenne published, I thought, was a very nice paper where he already looked, and he asked, are there interactions already on the front end? And he did sort of this very simple experiment. What happened is this is called the principal whisker, okay? And if he excites the principal whisker with a little bit of air, okay, he gets a little bit of a response when he excites with air. So it's just sort of what you expect. You puff on air and you excite this whisker. If he all of a sudden blocks air, but this little box means it's a little tube over this initial whisker, and again he excites with air. Okay, there's an aberrant spike and nothing happens. And again, this makes a little sense. And then what's happening here is he's injecting a little current into the cell, so it's giving the cell a lot of background firing outside of the regions where the air puffs are. The air puffs are these little dots at this point. And then he excites, he puffs air. So he's hitting no longer the center guy, but he's hitting these outside guys. And what happens is he finds out he actually suppresses activity, okay, at the point where he just pulls air on the outside guy without affecting the one in the middle. So this was data that says that the outside hairs are actually inhibiting the response of the central hair. And it's sort of telling you at the front end that you're not just reporting what's happening by exciting a given hair, you're reporting what's happening to that hair minus what's happening on the outside. So the signal that's getting through is already sort of this sort of spatial Laplacian. And this is caused, Martin went on to show that this is caused by actually interactions with this other nucleus called interpolaris. So he would do the same thing. He would excite with a little bit of air and you get this rather robust response, okay? And again, he'd block what's happening to the middle whisker, and there's no response. And then he'd block the middle whisker, add a little bit of air in this direction to jiggle it. And then he'd find out if he excited the outside whiskers, there's no longer an inhibitory response. Okay, so in a sense, what's getting into your brain now is not just some map of the outside world onto the inside. It's not a one-to-one map of the outside world going all the way up to cortex. Already, you're taking a derivative, a spatial derivative, okay, on the front end. So, and if you put the circuit together, what's happening is you have this trigeminal nerve, it's coming in, makes an excitatory connection on neurons in this one nucleus principalis, it goes on up to thalamus, but at the same time, it's also projecting to different areas. I've only drawn one of these in. It's projecting into interpolaris. Interpolaris has this inhibitory feedback, and that's actually sort of blocking the response. So you're sort of getting, this is getting you a center minus surround response already at the very front end. So it's sort of a warning, and if you just think of trying to make some linear filter that's taking you from the outside world to the inside world, it's not necessarily gonna work, because even at the very front end. Okay, this story actually gets a little richer, because you talk about arousal, and you talk about arousal being turned on by different cholinergic centers. PPN is a nucleus already in the brainstem. And this feedback circuit itself, okay, is severely heightened during attentional aspects through acetylcholine. What? Yes. Okay. So I mean that's the point. You could say, why did you have to use an anesthetized animal? I think it's just So this is this other reality, which is sort of the thing that keeps us alive in hospitals, right? When you add anesthesia, right, or analgesics, you know, you lose consciousness first, right? But your brain, the neurons in your brainstem keep going. If it was the flip, we'd all. So I don't know why, right? Okay, that sort of some network interactions are more important for consciousness than for things like breathing. You know, you could say it makes sense, but I really don't know why.
You know where the inhibitory neurons are?
I mean, this is. No, they're in interpolaris. Okay, that was out of Martin's work. This is not my work. Okay, so he's staying for things like GAD and other. Okay, in excitatory neurons, he stated for glutamate transmitters. Yeah, and I mean, if you want to actually, what's happening is you have a sort of you have inhibitory connections that go right on to the neurons in principalis. You also have inhibitory connections that are presynaptic. So it's very, very potent inhibition. Yeah. Okay. So what I want to go on now is to sort of move up and look at sort of feedback at the level of the thalamus. Okay. So excuse the sort of cartoon aspect, but let's see what happens with signals. So now we're coming out of, say, principalis, which was already, you sort of took a spatial derivative. We go into this thalamic area called ventral posterior medial thalamus, just VPM. Okay. These cells can be excited, okay, and these go up into into layer 6, and they also go to layer 4, which we'll get to. Okay, but the important point is there's already heavy feedback from layer 6 onto VPM, which I discussed a little bit in the beginning in the context of vision. But there's also feedback to this area called nuclear reticularis, okay, which has inhibitory feedback onto VPM. So this is feedback, okay, just within thalamus itself. So what's going on here? So again, the signal you get is not, you don't get coming up into cortex. It's a signal that goes straight through. You get a signal that has both positive feedback and negative feedback. Negative feedback that's local. So this was the issue of this feedback was looked into by Ehud Ha-Asar almost a decade ago. And Ehud recorded from both VPM and from another thalamic area called PO. And the point of this was actually very interesting. So if he stimulates the whisker, and he stimulates the whisker with ever-increasing frequency, okay? So the code is that, this is 2 hertz, 5 hertz, 8 hertz, 2 hertz, 5 hertz, 8 hertz, 11 hertz, okay? So as you go to higher and higher frequency, you know, you find out that actually the rate has somewhat adapted, okay? But the shape of the response, certainly the shape of the initial response, has not changed. Okay. On the other hand, you go to this other thalamic area, posterior thalamus, okay, what you find is that you increase the frequency, the time to peak gets longer and longer and longer. So phenomenologically, this was a finding in that the latency, the time to peak, okay, is basically a way to read out the frequency of whisking. So how could that happen, and what does this have to do with feedback? Okay, between this thalamic area and nuclear reticularis. I left out the N here. I'm sorry. So there was a body of work, it was primarily done by David Golem, that looked at the role of this of feedback, okay, between these two areas, between PO and nuclear reticularis, or VPM and nuclear reticularis. And what David just pulling together many people's intracellular data, the model that David has is the following, is that this thalamic area has strong input into nuclear reticularis. Nuclear reticularis has this inhibitory feedback, but the inhibitory feedback has two components. It has a fast inhibition, which is sort of GABA-mediated, okay, GABA-A-mediated, which is chloride, and it has another piece, which is the metabotrophic inhibitory receptor, which is GABA-B. And GABA-B takes time to build up. GABA-B takes time to build up. So the consequence is that when you go to higher and higher frequencies, okay, finally you could build up inhibition, okay, coming from nuclear reticularis and feeding back to this thalamic area. And what that does, in a sense, is it chews out this initial response. So as you go to higher and higher frequencies, you lost your initial response and you finally peak. The response peaks at later and later time. So the consequence of this is that the latency, which is shown here in red, goes up as a function of frequency. So we have a circuit that could take input frequency, like whisking frequency, and translate this into a latency in time. Okay. So again, the point here is that the signal that gets through is not just the original signal. The signal that gets through is a heavily modified signal due to feedback. In this case, it's feedback at the level of LGN. Okay, so the following now, I want to sort of make my way up into cortex and talk about feedback at the level of cortex. Okay, so this again opens up more of a puzzle than an answer. There's been this huge body of work. I don't know who exactly the first person who started this. I think it has more to do with Martin and Douglas, at the idea of this canonical cortical circuit, if such a circuit exists, which is that you could look at the wiring and realize that layer four cells, okay, inputs come into layer four primarily, west to layer six, like I described before. These project to upper layers and lower layers. I don't really want to go through this picture. This has sort of been worked out, but it's never, I don't think there's been ever a clear answer as to what this buys you computationally. I mean, it's just sort of an accident of development, or is there really some computation that comes out of it? And I think it's worth thinking about. I mean, there's, you know, big efforts in the world to put all the neurons in place, connect them up, warm up a lot of water in Lake Geneva, trying to understand what this circuit does. But let's look at something extremely naive that comes out of this, okay? So let's look at input that layer four input comes in, okay? And layer four input then goes on to excite layer three cells. On this picture, I've just put in the excitatory connections, okay, on purpose. And layer four cells also connect to the deeper neurons in layer five, both the small neurons and the very large projection neurons. But these two cell groups form an excitatory loop. So what would one expect from this? Okay. You know, you'd like to see some clue of this gives you some sort of explosive excitation, or maybe as Clay said, it puts the system at a hairline trigger. So do you really sort of end up with a sort of a cortex at the edge of seizure state? So this seems like the most dominant issue, okay? And then, Gaoping B is here, of course, and he did these beautiful experiments in culture. So this is taking all of cortex and, you know, turning it into a souffle. It's not quite cortex anymore, okay? But at least it was a proof of principle if you have excitatory cells hooked up among each other and you actually put in a stimulus, they'll just go and they'll fire off in this tremendous burst of activity. Okay, so the notion of cortical cells exciting each other in a recurrent loop, okay, in this sort of very model outside the brain state actually makes a lot of sense. And the other thing I think that came out of this, and maybe you'll talk about this, or maybe not. Okay, or maybe I talked about it for you. It's just that, in fact, you're of course very sensitive to blockers. Okay, if you put in blockers of excitatory transmission, okay, you basically lose this effect. So it's really mediated by cortical connections. So as a proof of principle, we looked at the circuit, we saw a dominant connection, we homogenized the brain, we looked at cortical connections, we see that it has this explosive activity. Yet, okay, if you go into an animal, either an anesthetized animal or an awake animal, so this is data from Dan O'Connor in Karel Svoboda's lab, I don't think this is even published yet. What in fact they do is, this is the vibrissa system, and they'll excite a given vibrissa. And you could ask, does this positive feedback actually cause this explosion of activity? What you find out is it causes very modest activity. It causes a small fraction of the cells, maybe 10 or 20% of the cells, to fire little bursts of sodium spikes, each of which gives rise to a calcium signal. So on the one hand, although there's this positive feedback, there's this propensity for explosive activity. In reality, you don't see it when you look at many cells. Now, get the order right. What you do see, though, is the following, if I did this right. Okay, so this is data from Carl Peterson. Oops. This is always so embarrassing because these things never work. Oh, yes. Just this document, always. Okay. Okay, I thought this is actually very wild. Let me just show you the picture, and then you'll see what's happening. Okay, you see? Okay, so keep in mind, this is voltage-sensitive dyes, which means these are molecules that are within the membrane of the cell that are recording the average cell. Okay, this sort of came up yesterday in Carl's talk. You're recording from every cell, and you're looking at you're averaging membrane potential for many, many cells in a given voxel, and you're actually confined mainly to the surface of the brain. So with all those caveats, okay, what Carl Peterson did, okay, I don't know how to stop it, is he stimulated, okay, so this is whisker angle, this is an awake animal, okay, so the animal is whisking and is touching an object, and he's looking at this voltage-sensitive dye signal, and he's seeing an area go off over here. This is the primary sensory area. I think here we go. The PC people don't want you to buy Macs. And then you're seeing an area go over here, which is the primary motor area. So the one thing you notice, though, is that this excitation, this spread of red, goes everywhere, right? And this was just a long time ago in the visual world, there's this phenomenon known as the McIlwain effect, right? You're recording from a cell, even in primary visual cortex. It has a receptive field over here. And you begin to wave your hand like this, and you find that the cell is sort of sparingly active. And I think the picture that's came out now from Carl's work and from Ron Frostig's work, and really you sort of see this in everybody's paper, but it just wasn't codified carefully until recently, is that sensory stimuli comes in, all of cortex gets a little bit depolarized. Okay, all of cortex gets a little bit depolarized. Not just depolarized, but from Ron Frostig's data, all of cortex gets a little bit of spiking. Okay, and what's happening here is the excitation comes in, and you just see it running as a front. Okay, so again, it's an open theoretical question, but the thing is this sort of positive feedback, which functionally is much like positive feedback you have in a single cell with a sodium channel, you hit a threshold, it turns on, it eventually refracts. Is this what's leading to this wave of activity that moves excitation completely across cortex? Okay, and then because I've left out all the inhibitory connections shut down. So we have to sort of ask ourselves, I think before we worry about canonical cortical circuits, we should first just think a little bit about just using the circuit just as sort of spread of activity. So what I showed you was input was coming in from the vibrissa through these trigeminal nuclei, through this thalamic area into S1. This is actually a brain slice. These areas connect. And then you saw the activity spread across cortex very quickly to M1 because there are direct connections. Well, all you're sensitive to with the dyes, the cortex is so scattering, right, that there's no imaging condition. It's just geometry. So they had kind of 100 micron pixels. So your depth and your width are about the same. So the most you could say it was in the first 100 or few hundred, right? So, I mean, even if you had connectivity in deeper layers, right, you're only sensitive to what's happening when things get to the upper layers. So it's one of these very nice one-off experiments, right?
Can you get something similar in SWAT?
I would just guess so. I'm only guessing so because it's been a good 20 years now where people use voltage-sensitive dyes in slice, and they would excite the white matter, and you see a little puff of activity start up in layer 4, and then a puff of activity move to 2, 3, and 5, and then you start to see it move laterally among the connections. This was data that came out of Rakin, but I don't remember who the authors were. So I imagine you could. And in particular, Josh Blumberg, this is actually his data, made these S1 to M1 slices. So there might be a very nice test bed to pull this together. Yeah.
I highlighted the activity of power to
Yeah, I know you'd complain.
Yeah.
So, no, go ahead. I mean, it's a fair point here, okay? I mean, I guess I was discussing them just in the sense of maintaining, there's two issues, okay. One is maintaining enough local excitation, right, which is maybe this analogy with Hodgkin-Huxley model. Of course, the propagation has to move, right? So you need cells connected to cells. So, it's hard to do this on the fly, if the speed is consistent with just sort of a narrow dendritic spread of a couple hundred microns for a given cell in layer 2-3, or if it's more consistent with projections over sort of the millimeter Wendt scale of 2-3 cells. So I can't answer that, Fred. Ugh, I can answer that if I can make this work. Okay, so primary sensory vibrissae area, the primary motor area, are connected by very strong connections, both through the white matter and through the upper layers. Okay, this I know personally, okay? And that, you already saw the motor area start first, okay? So that, I think, is governed by these connections that you're asking about, these layer 2-3 connections. So the spread must be just the dendritic spread, sort of the enlargement of this cloud. Yeah, I'm sorry I can't make this loop.
Why does the first wigger not trigger?
Okay, the first wigger doesn't trigger because this is when, so there's a signal in cortex which is due to self-motion, and that signal is relative, that's about a, from other data, not from this data, that's about a 20% modulation of the spike rate. Okay, if you just sit there and listen to spikes with an electrode, when the animal touches an object, you get an order of magnitude larger, about a 200% modulation in the spike rate. So somehow that very, very large increase is enough to trigger this entire set of events, which the sort of self-motion signal is not large enough to trigger. Yeah. So, okay, that's a good point. So I think, so Tom Wolseley, right, the other author on the Wolseley-Van der Lubbe paper, right, has a sort of, the barrels are something you see in layer 4, right? So if you look in a mouse, actually, the density of cells is lower inside the barrel than in the region between them. You just look at the density and see this. You could look at glial staining and see this. It's a real anatomical feature. But that's something you see in layer 4, which is about 500 microns down in the rat, and well below any depth of optical penetration for this picture. So the picture that Tom has is to view the barrels in a kind of hourglass sense, right? That you don't really have a tube running up and down, but you have the connection sort of branching off. So by the time you get to the upper layers, they're really overlapping, right? And you sort of lose that structure. Yeah.
So we did an experiment years ago in slice where we put a pupil in some blocker of inhibition, and now you get an epileptic wave. So you look at the epileptic wave, and you just look along the cortex, and look at the speed of propagation across the cortex. And if you had sliced just right, then the thing went like this, stepwise, and probably went with the barrel through the beginning of the cortex.
Maybe you can think of synapses.
Well, so what you can think of is the slope
footprints
floating, triggering with some delay the next area to explode, triggering with some delay the next area to explode.
I think it's like a little footprint of synapses.
So a little bit of a hop. And that, so there was some sort of a multiple. But I think, and this is a long time ago, but I think it was really dependent on exactly
I could just have this. We should have a wine and cheese party where we just play the movie. All right. Right, it might say Paul and Paul is dead or whatever would happen when you play the record backwards. Is that a I don't know. Did it do something for you, Steve? It was beautiful. I mean, fair is fair. Yeah. It's what tack? Yeah, this is an awake animal. The target is induced. So the animal is animal is whisking, and he introduces a pin. Comes into play. Okay, so that, yeah, so I think, let me, since you asked that, it is, and if I was smart, I brought this. Ah, okay, excellent. So, yeah, this is from same data set. It's definitely true that the size of the response that you measure with voltage-sensitive dye depends on, in some sense, what the mental state of the animal is. And there was no EKG measurement to know if the, you know, what this sort of alertness in the rat is a very good measure of sort of looking at power in sort of this 7 to 10-ish hertz band relative to very low frequency power, right? Sort of theta to delta, but I don't want to play those games. But you really can predict very well. They didn't measure that, but if you have the animal just sitting there, almost like it's having an absent seizure, like your little 12-year-old daughter sometimes does at the dinner table, then what happens is if you stimulate the whisker, you get this massive explosion of activity, okay? But the interesting thing is, so the stimulation here was done, you might say, in a way that was a surprise. It was a little magnetic particle hanging on the vibrissa, and then you'd pulse the field, right? So to move the vibrissa, you get this explosion. But if the animal is actually whisking, okay, so now it's quite attentive, you know, plotting on the same scale. So it doesn't mean that there's actually no activity, okay? You don't see this, okay? The flip is, if the animal is actually, if you do the previous experiment, right, where the animal is actually whisking and finally touches an object. So there's an expectation there's going to be an object in the field because it's rewarded for touching this object. Okay, you again get back to this explosion of activity. So there is this state dependence. Okay, but it's not, I don't think it's necessarily so easy to interpret at this point. Okay. Okay, is there any, I think the point, your logic point though is correct. That just the appearance of a stimulus can elicit sort of a startle reaction, right? In which the animal may just want to move off, right? Okay, so the last thing I wanted to do is to get back to where we started, right? So I described feedback at these various levels, and I think the point of this was to say that every time you move up in the sensory motor change, right? You're just constantly modifying the information by feedback from another area. There's sort of no notion of just sort of a series of linear filters progressing one after another. But what happens here? Okay, you already have the possibility of sensory motor feedback, right, already at the brainstem area. So let's get back to the facial nucleus and let's see what's happening at the front end. Okay, you kind of believe there has to be something, right? You touch a toaster, you know, you're not waiting for some conscious response. You want to get your hand off quickly, okay? So one thing that can be done is that it's the brainstem, and you could actually remove the brainstem from the animal and make a preparation in the dish, right? So you could study the feedback in isolation. So just as though you could take slices often and keep certain connectivity in the slices, thalamocortical cortical slices, cortical slices that maintain connectivity. In this case, you can maintain both the nerve coming in, and you can maintain the connectivity between this primary sensory area and this motor area. And what you're doing is then you're replacing, in a sense, the vibrissa follicle process with electrodes and a computer. Okay. So this is the preparation. Just as a technical issue, you can know, of course, you're in the fish or nucleus just by putting a dye in and seeing these cells light up. And then this becomes a way to guide your electrode. So the thing that happens is that if you stimulate the sensory nerve, okay, and you could record then, okay, the potential in the motor neurons. These are the motor neurons that drive the muscle. So there's really two possibilities. One is you stimulate the sensory nerve and I get some inhibition and I sort of turn off the muscles, which in this case would have the animal back off or vice versa. But the other possibility is I stimulate the motor neurons and the animal actually wants to push or vice versa forward. Okay, and coming into this, you could argue both ways. Okay, relaxing them is sort of the hot plate idea that you want to back off. And pushing a little bit forward is sort of the notion that you want to increase the signal to noise. You got a spike. Was it real because I touched something? Or is it just sort of a thermal event? So I'll push again, and I'll see if I get another spike. And that sounds like there's really an object in space. And experimentally, what you find is that when you excite the sensory neuron, you actually start to get extra spikes, okay, in the motor neurons. So this is a single trial, and if you average over many trials, what you do is you get this relatively short, you know, sort of 10, 12-ish millisecond latency event, okay, positive events. So what this is saying is that there's positive feedback already at the level of the brainstem. Okay, so you could do many experiments to sort of work out the physiology of this. But the question is, can you actually see this in an intact preparation? So this is now an anesthetized animal. And what we want to do is have the animal whack her vibrissa into an object and see if the muscles are activated to push the vibrissa forward. Okay? So we could excite this branch of this motor neuron, okay, which is going to drive the vibrissa, buccal labialis. And then I have a little contact meter, which I've taken out of the, which is here, okay, which I've taken out of the picture. So I excite, okay, and I see a nice EMG signal. There's nothing for the whisker to touch, and that's it, one shot. Okay, now what I've done is I've introduced a device, okay, a little piece of piezo material that the animal could actually whack her whisker into. So this is telling me both contact, and this is also providing a force back on the vibrissa, which in principle could trigger this positive feedback. So we do this, we stimulate, again, the muscle, we get a little EMG signal, okay? Here's our contact device went off, so the whisker actually banged into this object here, and then I get a second EMG signal as the rat tries to push forward. So the results that were obtained intracellular in a slice preparation are seen in these extracellular recordings, okay, from the muscle. So you really do have positive feedback. And then you kind of ask what's going on. So this, I can't compete with Carl for movies. I think you can make this work. Okay, wait, I got the... Okay, I'm sorry. I can't get the little movie to work. But the bottom line is this, is that I could look at motion now on both sides of the face, and I could ask, let me do a behavioral task. I'll just go back to show this picture, in which when the animal contacts a sensor, she gets a food reward. And let's ask if behaviorally this is going on, if behaviorally the fact that this positive feedback is increasing the force of the vibrissa. And I could do this by measuring the EMG on two sides of the face. So the EMG is a measure of neuromotor activity, but that's also sort of a measure of the force applied by the vibrissa. These are head-fixed rodents. That's not really important. And basically, when they hit a contact meter on one side, they get a food reward. What we see is the following. So the animal starts to whisk, recording whisking on two sides of the face. The animal's contact on one side, what I'm looking at here, is the time difference between the right and left side. And within the noise level, it's very, very flat. On the other side, if I look at the EMG, in fact, the EMG has a little bump. You get about 25% more force on the contact side versus the non-contact side. So what's being said then is this feedback at the level of the of the brainstem. The sensory motor feedback is already causing you to push harder on one side than the other. Okay, so I think what this comes out to, we saw, you know, from Martin Duchenne's data, that there's you tend to take a derivative, or actually like a second derivative in space to sharpen your response. Other data by Martin Duchenne says you tend to sharpen things in time. It's almost as like you're taking a single time derivative. From the data I showed you before, just a moment ago, already you have sensory, you're already getting feedback from the structure, which is sharpened in space and time, that goes back to the facial nucleus and sort of gives you a better clue as to whether there's an object. So already the front end is doing everything it can to increase the reliability of the signal and to sharpen the signal in space and time before it goes on to these higher levels, which you would think has something to do with decision making. Okay, so I just want to return a little bit, and this is just sort of a conjecture for where one could go in the future, and it is sort of a meeting on emerging technologies. And these neurons, and let me see if I actually, these neurons are have processes that are very long, and they're very spindly looking, so they really look like physicist neurons, like a little puffball with rays coming out of them, all right? And those rays are long. They're about 2 or 3 electrotonic lengths long. So what that means is that it really matters what the order of inputs are coming in, okay? Because one input is capable of shunting another input. So this is sort of, I think it's an important question because, as I mentioned before, these motor neurons are arbitrating inputs from many different levels, is to try to label these different neurons. There's a number of techniques. Swoboda's lab has a nice one, using chanorhodopsin and the axons, as Carl Diesdorf described yesterday. You could actually cause just the axons to fire. Maybe then you could sort of stack, you could use genetic tricks to have these various inputs and stack, and then look and see if they stack in a certain order, and see if one area, in effect, could subsume control over another area. Okay, so that's, I think these sort of upcoming tools are going to allow us then to sort of push this notion of control and feedback to another level. Okay, so we have 15 more minutes. We should take a little break, and I was just going to describe sort of a second issue to get back to sort of Mike's question about confluence of reafference and exafference. Okay, so are there any questions on this idea of feedback loops? Yeah. No, so the problem with putting a talk together is you realize how much you don't know, and it gets very embarrassing very quickly. So this is one of the great embarrassments of the Vibrissa system. They could wiggle their whiskers with this amazing precision when they want to, and no one's identified the clock. So there's an area in the brainstem called the cortica fusa area. I mean, the name shouldn't mean anything to anybody, but it actually controls the rhythm of breathing, and it controls particularly the rhythm of sniffing, right? And these synchronize. And in fact, when the animal is sniffing, the whiskers synchronize with the sniffing. Okay, so that's Martin and I are hunting very heavily to see if this is the clock. But I think that's just one of the areas that could subsume whisking, but I can't actually believe that that's the true underlying clock, because what?
The olive
has these like oscillations that are running around 7 hertz. So many years ago, Wally Welker went ahead and he did one of these Lashley experiments where you take a vacuum cleaner. You make a long list every day. Your technician brings you up a rat, and you suck out an area, right? And you suck out the olive, and the things will continue to whisk. There is an interesting point. I mean, the animal can whisk between 5 degrees, between 5 or 6 hertz, and upwards of this foveal whisking, up to within 20 to 23 hertz, right? There's this huge range. And what happens is, it's sort of a puzzle, right? It's almost like a line attractor or something. It picks a frequency, seemingly at random, and then it just whisks, right? We had a former student of mine, Rune Berg, sort of measured this very carefully. So just thousands of trials, right? Picks a frequency, whisks with all with this tremendous accuracy, right? You know, you take the Fourier transform, you look at the width of the peak, it's just almost like doing optics, right? And then it just picks another number 10 seconds later and whisks. So, I mean, you need a structure that not only can generate a good rhythm, but somehow is capable of generating that rhythm over a very wide distribution of frequencies. I mean, it peaks at 9 hertz, the distribution peaks at 9 hertz, but it's very broad. So that's a challenge.
And how does time sleep?
They don't do it. Anesthetized animals don't. There's this thing called twitching. This is very low amplitude twitching. And there's also some weird phenomena that people, you know, tuck into the discussion section because they really don't know if they believe it. But there's these sort of tremors, right? 14 hertz tremors, which I think are brainstem tremors. I don't know where they come from. They sit there in space and they also tremor at like 50 hertz. I don't know where that comes from. What? No. I mean, yeah, I know. Okay. Any other question? I don't know if we have. Okay. Let me just get a scope on this to make sure. I just want to go. I'll go through this kind of quickly. I want to make a point here. Sort of as a means of background, and the details don't matter so much. The previous sort of primer really had to do on the nature of feedback, and this primer, short primer, I just want to leave you with a sort of a simple notion, is that we talk about sensation as though the sensors are always fixed in space, right? We talk about it like it's a retina on a slab. Okay, but in fact, our sensors are always moving. So our eyes are always scanning. So the image that we have, right, is always drifting, okay, or even in a deterministic way across the retina. And we have to take this. So we, you know, you move your VOR system does everything it can to keep your head straight. But nonetheless, images slip. Okay, we touch things with our hands, right? So whether my arm is here. My arm is here, the pressure signal, right? Or my fingertips is the same, but I know where the objects are. So the act of sensation can't be divorced from the motion control of the sensors themselves. And I think this is just an important point that all sensation is active. Olfaction is active. You're sniffing. Maybe not us so much, but you know, in the morning I go to my dog, Ava, ears are up. Right? She's looking around, right? So you're always moving your sensors. And the only way for you to localize objects in space is to pay attention to a pathway that also tells you where those sensors are, right? So this was actually, you know, Helmholtz talked about this, and von Holst in the 50s sort of brought this point up. And this really should be, sort of chapter 2 in Kandel and Schwartz. But it's not, which is a mistake. And he had a very nice language, and he talked about environmental factors coming in, which he called X afferents, that's the pressure on your fingertips, and he talked about the motor activation of these sensors, and that's this word called reafferents. And these are words you're kind of familiar because you're kind of familiar with this idea of proprioception, right? This idea that you actually have a signal that tells you where your sensors are in space, and sort of the most common one of these signals actually has to do, say, with the angle of a joint or the force exerted by a muscle on the joint. And von Holst also talked about this notion of peripheral reafferents. He talked about this in the 50s, and that the same sensors could encode both motor activation and environmental stimuli. So I want to demonstrate this. So Steve Schell did this nice experiment, right? In the textbooks, it's nice to take sensors and separate the ones that are responsible for motor control from the ones that are responsible for sensation. Okay, but Steve's point is that you're really using the same sensors for both. So he sort of tried to go beyond, not the essence of von Holst, the essence of von Holst really being that you need sensors to tell you where objects are, but the idea that you just have completely separate channels. This is what Steve Schell did. So I need another. Okay, these are. unfortunately the same size. But pretend that that's a wine glass, and that this is something big. Oh, here we go. All right. I knew these. Finally, these cups are useful. Okay. So Steve Shao asked a number of human participants to pick up objects, and the objects were cylinders, and they had different diameters, and they had different surface textures, right? And they had to differentiate them. So you'd pick something up, and then he'd give you another object, and you'd go, same difference, right? Just match after sample, right? You did this over and over again. So you're very good at picking smooth versus rough, skinny versus thick. Two cups that were both thin, or both shiny or smooth, you can say, okay, thin, thick. Okay. Then he'd go in and he put lidocaine in the stretch receptors, okay, in your fingers, right? So you sort of lost the ability now to know how big your hand is, right? But you didn't lose your fingertips, right? So what happens? Besides sort of embarrassing yourself at a cocktail party, what happens? Yeah, you can't tell size anymore. But it was sort of, you know, it's a simple experiment, right? So you certainly knew rough versus smooth, right? But you really couldn't tell the difference between that club glass, okay, and the wine glass, okay? So the point is just that all the bend receptors, which you use for feedback for motor control, you also use for sensation, okay, and vice versa. Okay, and in fact, if you go back to our friend, and you look even in thalamus. Now this was a map. There was a map made in the 1960s, and there was a second map made in the mid 1970s. And then fast forward 30 years later, 30 plus years later, and there's a third map made of proprioception. So it's almost an embarrassment. I mean, there must have been 100,000 visual maps made in that time. But John Chapin made this very nice map, okay, of the exafferent signal, right? This is taking an anesthetized animal and just mapping where in thalamus, okay, that you get the center of the response, which you're just touching, you know, various parts of the paw and the fingers, okay? And then he made another map, okay, a proprioceptive map by bending. Now, you have to be a little bit careful because as you bend, you're also stretching the skin. Right, so either you have to inject lidocaine into the skin, or because it's an anesthetized animal, you could actually just surgically remove remove the skin. So these maps don't sit on top of each other. They sit about a millimeter apart, which is quite a fair distance in thalamus. Okay, but it opens up this very real question, is that you have these two separate maps, okay, and these two separate maps have to come together. Okay, and so this is the point I'm going to leave you with. Now, we're running out of time. I'm just going to go quickly and say, we looked at this issue in the rodent. The confluence of maps of position with maps of touch, you would have maybe liked to do this, okay, with the touch system, the hind paw system. But as I mentioned in the rodent, you had this great advantage of sort of very simple behavior, very rhythmic motion. So experimentally, we were able to show that if you ask a rat with a single whisker to tell you where a pin is in space, here versus here, okay, the rat could actually do this with one whisker. So think about what that means, okay? If the rat has lots of whiskers, there's a lot of ways it could tell you that a pin was forward versus back. It could hit with many hairs. It could look at the latency. There's all sorts of triangulation codes. But in fact, if it has a single hair, it has to know where this hair is in space in order to touch. Okay, so this says that we can use the vibrissa system, the system with this great clock, okay, to go ahead and tell us something about a reafferent signal as to where things are in space and a touch signal. Okay, so I'll skip that experiment. And I'm going to go ahead and record from primary sensory cortex and just give you a little bit of a flavor for both signals. Okay, so coming into this problem, we knew something about the anatomy. And this is mostly comes, the data is a little controversial, but I think the best of it comes from Martin Duchenne. There's a Vibrissa pathway that's coming out of the brainstem. It comes up into thalamus. It goes up into these barrel areas. These are these beautiful barrels. And I think, Adrian, you might see is that they're very, very well defined at the level of layer four, but they get sort of at least less defined as you move up and up and up. Okay. Like I said before, there's this inhibitory feedback that could sharpen the response at the level of nuclear reticularis. But there's another pathway, and this is a pathway that carries motion information. Okay, there's a little bit of argument over the details of this pathway, but for the moment, that's unimportant. The thing that's important is there are neurons that carry information about where the vibrissa is in space. There are neurons that carry information about contact, as we'll see in a moment, and these can interact. So somehow, what you need in the brain is that you have information as to where the sensor is, and you have information as to the activation of the sensor. And you need to merge this information to know where an object is, right? To know where the object is relative to where the limb is, okay? And that's, I think, the essence of sensation. And it, the question can be formulated in the following way. In the vibrissa system, the sensory signal is contact. And you could ask, I measure a contact signal, and I look for that contact signal relative to where I am in the Wyss cycle. And if I could fire just as easily in any position, then this neuron tells me that it made contact, but it doesn't tell me where that contact took place. So it's not telling me where the object is. But if I look at the probability of spiking of a cell upon contact with an object, and that signal varies depending on where my whisker is in space, or my limb is in space, okay? So there's some hump at some phase, okay? Then in fact, I have the merge of two signals, and it's told me where that object is in space, and it sort of fulfilled the notion of sensation. Okay, is everybody with me? So the basic experiment is really simple. Okay, so this was started with many years ago with work with Michael Fee when he was a postdoc and was just completed with a fellow named John Curtis. So I'm sorry for sort of pushing our own data. It's sort of the only data I know on this issue. You have neurons that are weakly modulated as a whisker moves back and forth in space. So these are rhythmically modulated because the whisker is moving back and forth in space. So this is this 20% modulation, okay, of the spike rate just due to the change in position, okay? Then what I could do is, these are awake animals, obviously, behaving animals. They could do a task, and they'll touch an object, okay, and within this whisking cycle. And what we'll see, in fact, is if I add up the touch at every possible position, okay, what you find is you get this huge modulation in rate. Okay, you could just see that this is almost like a 100% change in rate. But the important thing now is to say, aha, I'm going to take the touch events that happened here, the touch events that happened here, the touch events that happened here. I'm just going to cluster them together in little ranges, okay, little angular ranges, and have them, and then see, okay, in fact, if there's an interaction. And I need to plot this on a log scale because this is a 20% modulation, and this is like 100% modulation. So if I look at this background, this is just spiking, okay, due to motion of the vibrissa, and this big peak is caused by contact, okay? This is caused by contact here versus here versus here versus here. This is a log scale, right? So if it's the same strength of contact every place, the height of this should be the same. But in fact, finally, at one particular location in the Wyss cycle, I get a very, very, very large hump. So this constitutes a nonlinear interaction that says that this neuron likes to spike if it makes contact at a particular place. So this is the confluence, okay, of these two pathways, one reporting sensor position and one reporting the act of contact. And if I go ahead and try to make that picture I showed before, where I look at the strength of the response of touch, depending where I am in the Wyss cycle, I get essentially a tuning curve. Okay. Okay, so this happens at all different phases in the Wyss cycle. And now I just sort of want to leave you with a puzzle, and I'll end. So I showed you that there are units that respond to contact as a function of where you are in the Wyss cycle. Different units have different preferred locations. Some like to spike here, some like to spike here, some like to spike here. You cover the entire space. Okay. So now there's another aspect of sensation, general aspect we have to think about, which is what coordinate system do you use? OK. Okay? So the simplest thing is to think of coordinate systems that map real space onto your space, like mapping retinal coordinates. Okay, but we know that can't always be true, because there's a sort of very famous experiment done by Charlie Gross, where he was recording things from VIP, and he was looking at a coordinate system, okay, and you'd be foveating here, but every time you moved your hand, the reference system just moved with the position of the hand. So it's clear there are coordinate systems which are tied to real space, and there are coordinate systems, you might say, that are tied to the center of the action itself. Okay, so what's happening in this case? Well, when rats whisk, they could whisk over this huge range. Okay, but as you pointed, as you asked about, Fred, there was this foveal whisking. But, and what they'll usually do is just pick a little range in space, and they'll whisk within that range. And then for a different task, they may whisk within this range. So it's funny, right? Because what's happening is that at any given point in time, they're all using a small region of their space. So I can normalize to that region. I can say they're whisking from here to here, so this is 0, and this is pi, and then I'm back at 2 pi or 0. Or I could say they're whisking in a coordinate which is just 0 degrees, 180 degrees. So if we use these normalized coordinates, which are focused on the region of interest, we get very nice tuning curves. If we reanalyze the data, of course we're tracking everything with the camera, we find out there's no tuning. So this was kind of interesting, and it gets back to a point that actually Adrian made some time ago in the nature of fly vision. So we have this dilemma, and this is sort of a theoretical issue, is that we could have had coding based on angle, and that's very unambiguous because every neuron is just tagged like a labeled line with a given angle. So what this means is that if I'm whisking within this region, only some small fraction of cells could potentially be active as I'm whisking within this region, and the rest will be off, right? So we're not using their activity at all. But there's no ambiguity, because if I shift the range I'm whisking in, now there's a different set that will be active, and I can report what's going on. Okay, so that's one possibility, but this appears experimentally not to be the case. The other possibility is I shift to this sort of abstract representation, this phase representation, okay, where absolute angle, you know, just looks like the real part of this, plus some offset. And here, everybody is active, because I've renormalized to this range. And this looks like what the rat is doing. But it's ambiguous, because I need to know something about these constants. I need to know the amplitude of the whisking, and I need to know the midpoint. So experimentally, we went on, and I'll just say this is work which is being finished up. This is Dan Hill in the lab. If you look at motor cortex, the other area that I showed you earlier from Carl Peterson's measurements, you actually find neurons that report the midpoint and that report the amplitude. Okay, so I could take my whisking bout, I could extract out an amplitude, which is like an envelope, I could extract out a midpoint, and I find neurons that encode this. So it seems that neurobiology, by some unknown circuit, made a choice for some unknown reason to take a scene, to decompose it into sort of a fast-changing variable, a phase, in a normalized coordinate, and then get these extra sort of slow variables, sort of constants, right, and use that for coding. So again, I sort of leave this as a theoretical issue, but I think as we think about sensation, we have to think about this motion of the sensors. So you always have to think about the motion coming together, the signal itself to tell you where objects are in space, and we also have to think about the coordinate system. And thank you. On time. Okay. All right, Boris, you're nodding your head without a bump on your nose. Yeah. These are in motor cortex. Yeah. So I mean, so unlike the monkey that has 17 motor cortical areas, you know, or sensory areas are divided very sharply by sulci. So these are in frontal cortex, but there's direct connections between vibrissa, primary sensory neurons, and motor neurons. In a sense, it's a simpler circuit. Okay. Mean something that codes kind of the envelope. I mean, the only thing I know is like from the electric fish, right? That it puts out a fast. You get this fast oscillating field, and you're really interested in looking at the envelope of the receive field, right? To know if there was like an object, right? Because that object will sort of be a change in the impedance of the wire. So there's been phenomenologically, there's been records of the envelope. Okay, so that's one analogy. You would think this would be in the bat literature, but I looked pretty hard and I couldn't, because that has sort of the same thing. You might want to find the envelope, but apparently that's not. You mean some slowly varying feature? I'm not sure. Adrian, do you have an idea? Yeah, so maybe because of brevity, I made it a little more simplistic. So about the neurons that follow the motion in real time, which we just call phase, but that's not important. They're about 80% of the response in primary sensory area, and some of these envelope cells, which are about 20%. And actually, it's kind of interesting because the phase-sensitive ones are definitely peripheral reafferents in the sense if you block motion of the vibrissa, you lose that information, but you don't lose the envelope information, okay, either an S1 or an M1. So we can do sort of sensory block experiments. Okay, and in primary motor cortex, you have a small number of these rapidly changing phase cells, but again, you're about 80% dominated by these slow. I mean, nothing's, you know, 2/3 is victory, I'd say, yeah. Yeah.
And then the
correct.
So the same cell can be like a different
number. Yeah, that's the ambiguity. So just paying homage here to my co-organizer. But I mean, this is an experimental situation that's relatively easy to achieve, right? The rat will change her range of whisking. Right. You know, she's approaching a target. She's approaching a target by moving and perching. Okay. Or if you want to do this in a more constrained way, you could have the animal in a little mummy bag, sort of like you swaddle little kids, and so she could still move her head. And then you could change where the target position is. So that will also change the midpoint. Right. So you could do this either completely free or partially constrained. So one could easily achieve okay these situations. So it's always with respect to the same phase in the whisk cycle that neuron responds. So it's pretty simple in a sense to analyze after the fact. So if that's the question. So we never found that. Maybe that name foveal whisking was a little bit unfortunate because I was just thinking of the, maybe she called it forward. I mean, it's not so important. I don't think there is, I mean, fovea in vision means a region of high density where the rat likes to, where you like to keep an object, but it's really because of high density of receptors, high acuity. So the analog here, if the whiskers are all the way forward, they're very close, but I'm not sure that's a region of high acuity because then the hairs are on top. Okay, that's. Yeah, I could. Okay, so I could show you this. So, matter of fact, I skipped over this in issue of brevity. So, this is showing the relationship. When the animal just whisks in air, the neurons will produce extra spikes at a particular phase in the whisk cycle. Okay, and different neurons have different preferred phases. And then you could ask if that matches a preferred phase for touch, right? I mean, so it has to be related. The question is what's the offset? And the offset is, you know, zero. And the joke is that this is as straight a line as you'll ever get in neurobiology. But you could see, but there is a preferred phase. And what's happening is that there's a bit of a bias for neurons that like to spike when the whiskers are actually going back. Now they actually make, you know, they're whisking like this. They're whisking in sort of very eccentric ellipses. Okay, maybe like 20-to-1 aspect ratio. So I was ignoring this part in that discussion, and they tend to like to make contact moving back here. But this is a small effect, right? So they span the space, but there's a bias. So I don't know if they actually use this bias or what, but this is just experimental, right? It's not anywhere as dramatic as in the retina, where you have an order of magnitude increase in density, differences in cell types, etc. Yeah. Okay, we should break. Okay. So we're at 11? Okay, so sneak back here in 15 minutes. So the first week is kind of high saturation, but